I want you to use your imaginations this morning. First, imagine the television was never invented, and neither was the radio. Now, imagine that the printing press never made it off Gutenberg's drawing board, meaning there are no books, no magazines, no newspapers, no mass media of any kind. If none of these things existed, what would you be able to tell me about the assassination of John F. Kennedy? You almost certainly would know about that event because you would have heard the story, and you would still be sharing that story with others, with your family, with your children, because the story is important enough that it deserves to be remembered and passed on. Now, still imagining that the story of the Kennedy assassination was never put in writing, I ask you to consider how the oral traditions surrounding that story might have developed. With no mass communication, would the people in Dallas tell the exact same story as the people in Washington, D.C.? If you asked a person in Georgia to tell you about the day JFK was killed, would you hear the same word-for-word account you would hear from a person in Idaho? You've all heard of that party game where one person whispers a story in the ear of the person beside him, and as the story makes its way around the room, it gets completely changed. The first person whispers something like, "Uncle Abner is a policeman and his phone is dead." By the time the story makes the full circle, the last person in the room is running out screaming, "Phone the police, somebody killed Uncle Abner." Such is the natural progression of oral stories. And today, 37 years after the actual event, the story of the Kennedy assassination would be told differently in different communities, each community having developed the story in its own peculiar way. In fact, with no news coverage and only a few hundred eyewitnesses to the actual event, that story would have been told 100 different ways right there in Dallas before nightfall on the day it happened. What has this to do with today's Bible passage? Well, as I indicated, John F. Kennedy was assassinated a little over 37 years ago. As it happens, that is the length of time most Bible scholars believe passed from the time Jesus was crucified until the first account of his life was put in writing. Jesus was crucified sometime between 30 and 33 A.D., and the first written account of his life and death was written sometime around 70 A.D., about 37 years after the fact. I bring this up not to canonize John Kennedy, but rather to provide a historical perspective to the way the Bible stories developed. One of the most interesting aspects of current Bible scholarship is the search for the sources behind the four Gospels. All four Gospel stories are different. Where did the writers of those Gospels get their information? All of their accounts were written long after the death of Jesus. Those authors we refer to as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't pull their accounts out of thin air. They had sources of information which they used to write their Gospel stories. What were those sources? First, let me set the Gospel of John aside. John's Gospel is so different from the other three, from its theology to the way it is written to the way it portrays Jesus, that the study of John is a separate field of study from the other three Gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called the Synoptic Gospels because they tell a similar story and even share a lot of the exact same information. Mark was the first gospel to be written, sometime around 70 A.D. We do not know for sure what sources Mark used to write his account, but because this writing is the first written account of the life and death of Jesus, the assumption is that Mark wrote the story just as he had heard the story told to him. To put that task in perspective, it would be like one of us today attempting to write the first account of the Kennedy assassination based only on the stories we have been told about that day. When we read the gospel accounts of Matthew and Luke, which were written 10 or 15 years after the gospel of Mark, one thing becomes clear. Both Matthew and Luke had a copy of Mark in front of them when they wrote their gospel stories. In fact, they used Mark's gospel as the outline for their stories and copied large parts of Mark word for word. The next thing we notice when we examine the gospels closely is that Matthew and Luke have quite a bit of material in their gospels that is peculiar to their individual accounts. In other words, there are some things that Jesus says and does that can be found only in Luke, and there are some things that can be found only in Matthew. What are the sources of that material? Scholars generally agree that as the story of Jesus was spread by word of mouth, different churches in different locations fell victim to that problem inherent in the party game. They told the story and modified the story in slightly different ways. So there are two oral traditions at work here, which scholars call M for Matthew and L for Luke. M and L are the designations for material that is found only in Matthew or only in Luke. Now, I know I'm throwing quite a bit at you here because what you are getting is basically an entire New Testament seminary course in about 7 minutes. But stay with me just a little bit longer because this is where I think it really starts to get interesting. So far, we have three sources of material for the gospel stories: Mark, which is the first written source, and the two oral traditions developed in Matthew's and Luke's community, which we call M and L. Let's say we're looking at copies of Matthew and Luke, and we go through and mark out everything they borrowed from the Gospel of Mark. Now let's go through and erase everything that is M or L material, everything that is peculiar to either Matthew or Luke. Now we've done away with two of their sources, Mark and each of their oral traditions. And guess what is left? A large group of sayings of Jesus that are identical. They are found in both Matthew and Luke and nowhere else in the Bible. Now, our first impulse is to say, well, either Mark or Luke must have had a copy of the other guy's gospel, and that's why they have all those identical sayings. One of the two copied those sayings from the other guy's account. Scholars don't think that's what happened, because in most cases, those sayings appear in completely different contexts. For example, Matthew might have Jesus saying some words to a large group gathered on the side of a hill, while Luke has Jesus saying those exact same words to just one of his disciples as they walk alone. This has led scholars to conclude there was a written list of the sayings of Jesus, and that Matthew and Luke each had a copy of that list. Obviously, this would mean that somebody wrote down the sayings of Jesus before Matthew and Luke wrote their gospels. This intrigues scholars because they are always searching for the earliest source of information regarding Jesus. The thought is that the earlier sources may be more authentic since they were written closer to the events they actually describe. Now, the idea that there is a list of sayings of Jesus that predates the Gospels is exciting for those of us who study the Bible. Sadly, that list has never been found. And there are some cynics who say that list has never existed anywhere outside the imagination of modern scholars. But that has not kept scholars from reconstructing that list by singling out those identical sayings found in both Matthew and Luke. And this list of sayings is considered to be one of the most important sources for the gospel stories as we know them. Of course, this source needs a name. Well, the German word for source is Quelle, Q-U-E-L-L-E, and the first letter of that word, Q, is what this undiscovered source is called. If you go down to Barnes & Noble and examine the theology section, you'll discover lots of books dedicated to Q. And believe me, at this point in time, there would be no prize in all of archaeology as coveted as the discovery of an actual ancient manuscript of Q. Well, today's Bible passage from the lectionary text is found in the 6th chapter of Luke, and it is a collection of Q sayings. Luke placed several Q sayings together in what we call the Sermon on the Plain. Likewise, Matthew gathered several Q sayings together, and that collection is called the Sermon on the Mount. As is the case with Q material, there is no complex theology, no intricate layers of philosophy to work through. These are the basic moral teachings of Jesus, dealing with how life should be lived. Further, unlike large parts of the gospel stories, which scholars believe were inventions of the gospel writers and modifications of the original story by their communities, it is widely held that the words attributed to Jesus, which we study this morning, were indeed actually spoken by that man, Jesus of Nazareth. You heard most of this passage read this morning from the lectern. Let me repeat just the first and last lines, since they provide us with more than enough to think about in one morning. Jesus says, "But I say to you, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you." And then, "Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Forgive, and you will be forgiven." I don't know about you, but as far as I'm concerned, these are some pretty hard teachings to swallow. First, there is this idea of loving our enemies and doing good to those who hate us. That is easier said than done. I've been fortunate in that I haven't made many enemies in this life, but like every other person who has ever lived, I've crossed swords with some folks along the way. I don't live up to this ideal. When I read the Faith and Values section in the Saturday Wichita Eagle, I always enjoy reading about local ministers. What are their favorite books? What movies have affected them? And who are their role models? I am always humbled when one writes that his or her role model is Jesus Christ, because I'm sure they mean what they say, and they are setting for themselves a higher standard than I would dare set for myself. I know myself too well. Try as I may, I just can't live up to that standard. When Jesus was nailed to the cross, he actually loved the people who were killing him. He endured that torture and loved the people who were inflicting unmentionable pain and humiliation upon him. Would I like to possess that kind of love, that level of devotion to the perfect love of God? You bet. Do I? Not even close. When somebody does me wrong, it angers me. I can even hold a grudge if I'm not careful. Is Jesus my role model? Jesus is something much more than that to me. He is an ideal, the ideal of a person who so gave himself to God that he became a reflection of God's love. I dare not even imply that I am capable of modeling my life after the life lived by Jesus of Nazareth. In fact, if I am really honest with myself, when I reflect on the crucifixion, I can see myself in those who looked on in silence, or even in the authority figures who perpetrated that injustice, at least as much as I can see myself in the Holy One upon whom that injustice was inflicted. But you know, I believe that is the whole point. This law of love, the idea that we are to love those who hate us, is meant to show the gulf between the perfect righteousness of God and the way you and I actually think and act. What we have here is the supreme ideal. What we have here is the gospel saying, "Do you think you're perfect? Okay, if you are perfect, If you embody the perfect love of God, then love the people who hate you in the way Jesus did. This isn't so much a teaching as it is a warning against self-righteousness. The commentary for this passage from the Interpreter's Bible puts it this way: the loftiness of the challenge which Jesus here presents exalts us with a sense of the glory of God, and in the same moment humbles us to the dust with the consciousness of our utter inability to measure up to the idea he has set before us. A friend of mine who teaches theology at United Seminary in Dayton, Ohio, says of passages like this, "It just sort of makes you feel like pond scum." Pond scum is one of his favorite metaphors. Well, this is really not the way the gospel is intended to make us feel. Actually, that pond scum feeling is supposed to be a short stopping off place on the way to the grace of God. But it is only in realizing that we are indeed imperfect that we can approach life as humble children of God. Acknowledging our imperfections is the first step in an honest relationship with God. If we can't love with the perfection of Jesus, we can still love. And there is a very practical side to this teaching, this love those who hate you, as impossible as that may be. There is a law in this world that is undeniable. Hatred begets hatred. Anger begets anger. Violence begets violence. We see this so often in everyday life, we don't even think about how true it is. A person argues with his neighbor over the lawnmower or how a car is parked or some other trivial issue. The neighbor responds by saying bad things about the complainer to other neighbors. Soon, they're not speaking to each other. A week later, their kids are fighting on the school bus. The universal law of cause and effect kicks in. The violence and hatred feed on each other, and the situation spirals out of control. Unless somebody has the courage and conviction to bring love into the picture. When one neighbor looks over at another neighbor and sees a child of God and resolves to be understanding and loving regardless of what has gone before, the cycle of violence just stops. It can no longer feed on itself. And finally, the Hatfields and the McCoys shake hands and agree to fight no more. It sounds idealistic and childlike and simplistic, but that doesn't make it any less true. When one person turns to the other and says, "I can't fight you any longer because I love you," the fighting stops. And so this basic teaching of Jesus, love those who hate you, serves a second purpose. Not only does it remind us of our imperfections, it also establishes a basic rule of life. When hatred battles against hatred, only hatred can win. There is no other option. Love does not have a chance unless somebody consciously brings love into the conflict. The last part of today's Bible passage isn't any easier to swallow than the first. "Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Forgive, and you will be forgiven." This seems to be an underlying premise of much of the teaching of Jesus. There is a certain justice that permeates the universe. Jesus doesn't say, "God will never judge you, and God will always forgive you." That is certainly what we would like to hear Jesus say, but he doesn't. He says quite specifically, "Don't judge, and you will not be judged. Forgive, and you will be forgiven." In another place, Jesus says, "The measure you give will be the measure you get." We don't like to talk about this in the modern church, but a big part of the message of Jesus seems to be that we are actually responsible for the things we say and do. Now, I don't personally believe in a hell that exists beyond the grave, and I really can't envision standing in line at the pearly gates. But I do believe there is some part of our being that is eternal. And Jesus clearly indicates that we are accountable to God for every word we've ever said and every deed we've ever done. The universe, he seems to say, is a just place. I would venture this is not what most of us really want. Do we really want a just universe? Do we really want God to judge us only with the same amount of love and understanding that we have when judging other people? To forgive us for our shortcomings and selfishness only to the degree that we forgive people whose selfishness has harmed us? These are hard sayings of Jesus we're dealing with this morning, made especially difficult by the fact we can't pass them off as the invention of the gospel writers. Scholars believe Jesus really did say this stuff. But you know, I view these words of Jesus regarding judging and forgiving in the same way I view his words about loving our enemies. They are meant to set before us an ideal which both challenges us to be better people and at the same time humbles us out of any sense of self-righteousness. And let's give Luke a little credit here. He seems to recognize and accept our shortcomings a little more than Matthew does. In the passage for this morning, Matthew wrote one of the lines like this: "Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." Luke wrote it this way: "Be merciful as your heavenly Father is merciful." My hope is that Luke's words are a more accurate reflection of the actual words of Jesus, because I think we can all agree we have a much better chance of being merciful than we do of being perfect. Ultimately, I believe God will forgive us, will love us more than we'll ever be able to love others, but I believe we should always strive to be more loving. I believe God will judge us less harshly than we are inclined to judge those around us, but I do believe we are called to be less judgmental people. I believe God will forgive our shortcomings with an abundant mercy we are simply incapable of exhibiting toward those who have harmed us, but I believe we should constantly attempt to be more forgiving people. I really think Luke got it right. Our call as people of faith is not to be perfect, but to be merciful, to acknowledge our imperfections and seek God's strength each day as we strive to be more loving and forgiving. May we draw on each other's strength to make it so. Amen.